RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Dark to Light podcast with Frank and Beans. Frank will be in this interview with we're about to do. We went a little over because it was just riveting and we couldn't stop. And so he had to jump off at the very end. But we interviewed Celia Farber, investigative reporter. Her bio is amazing. The work she's done is amazing. She has done work for Uncover DC that really has been, I don't use this word lightly, revolutionary in the COVID coverage. And we talk about that a bit in the interview. But what we really talk about today is HIV and the real story of what happened with HIV and what may be happening with HIV today. And it's really just an entryway into the story. We didn't get into the minutia, the detail of all of this. We kind of stayed surface level and pecked around a bit. And Celia will be back because somebody needs to write a book about her story. It is absolutely incredible. I am honored to work with her. I'm honored to have been an editor for this amazingly talented and passionate journalist. I hope you guys enjoy this. Quickly, before we jump into the interview, I talked briefly about this on Friday. There is a give, send, go up to try and raise some funds for my legal fees. Tomorrow is the court case, the motion to dismiss. I will put the link to that in the show notes along with everything that we talked about today and Celia's Substack. God bless all of you guys. I hope you enjoy the show today. And again, we'll have Celia back. Share this with all of your friends. An absolutely stunning interview with journalist Celia Farber.
Ready?
All right, so we are super, super excited to be joined by Celia Farber, who I'm going to make a little personal note about after this, but she's a print journalist who started investigating and documenting the war on American science waged by Fauci's emerging HIV-AIDS superstate in the late 1980s. She began her investigative articles in Spin magazine, wrote there for about 10 years against tons of opposition. And then in 2006, she published an article in Harper's Magazine called Out of Control, AIDS and the Destruction of Medical Science that was both about pharmaceutical murder and about the American Fauci-led system of ruining dissenting sciences who dissent from the public health PSYOP narrative, right? So she was actually attacked because of that, too. And she's the author of Serious Adverse Events and Uncensored History of AIDS. And before I welcome her, I need to say this to preface the show, because I met Celia because she was writing a walkaway piece for Epoch Times. And we became very, you know, very friendly, and we collaborated and talked. And then I asked her if she'd be if she would humble me by writing for Uncover DC, to which she agreed to do. And when COVID first started happening, we were on the phone all the time talking about it. And she told me what she's about to tell you guys today. And I said, holy crap. Unfortunately, the public's not ready to hear this yet, but I think they're ready now. So, Celia, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tracy. I'm really happy to be on the show. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Lots to talk about.
Yeah, tons to talk about. And it's all really important. So I want to speak about the past today, Celia, because people don't realize, I said this to Julie Kelly, too, and she agreed with me, that when you're a journalist covering a story of such importance like this, you become like, you know more about it than the people that are in it themselves, because you're seeing it from all over the spectrum, and you become that story. It is everything to you. And so you have a hell of a story to tell, and I want you to tell people. I guess we'll start with, how did you start covering this to begin with? And then, you know, who were some of the people you met along the way that became really impactful and you developed relationships with, et cetera?
Yeah, it started. So I knew I wanted to do print investigative journalism and really at a really young age. I don't know. I think my earliest memory of knowing that was I was sitting at a diner on the Upper West Side. I had come back from Sweden where I grew up. I was a native New Yorker, but transplanted to Sweden in a custody battle as a child. So I grew up in Sweden, came back. I think I was 19, and I was in a program in college where they encouraged life experience credits. at NYU. So that meant, you know, try to go out and get an internship at a place where you'd like to work. I was a journalism major and only for one semester, and then ran out of there screaming and became a classics major. Anyway, I picked up a copy of Spin magazine, and it had the expose of Live Aid, Bob Geldof's Live Aid, by a really amazing journalist named Bob Keating, who later became the person who trained me and taught me everything I know. And it was, so it was this, it fit with this three-word creed my father had given me. He was a radio broadcaster, pioneering radio broadcaster, who broadcast for 60 solid years. And to the, literally the last night of his life, he died on May 6, 2020. I didn't grow up with him, but I asked him for advice about journalism when I came back to the States. And he said, I can sum it up for you in three words, darling. And the three words were penetrate the ostensible. And I went, wow, penetrate the ostensible. So this Live Aid piece in Spin was exactly that, like sacred cow. Everybody thinks this is the best humanitarian miracle that's happened. All these rock stars, but we'll go behind and under. There was all kinds of complicity with the Mengistu regime. They were making the situation worse. More people were dying of famine and displacement. And it was just unbelievable. So I just, everything lit up for me. Like, that's what I want to do. Penetrate the ostensible, investigative, long form print journalism. Okay, so I probably wasn't that clear about it at the time, but so I called them up and I got an internship and began to work. And AIDS was then, so we're now talking, this is actually 1980s, it's like 85, 86. By 86, I'm at the magazine daily and I'm beginning to gather reports about AIDS, which had begun to kind of possess me. I think it began to possess me because I was, like everybody else, certain I would die of it. Because we all belonged to, in the very beginning, they terrorized us with what was called tertiary transmission. So that meant, okay, first of all, everybody who's sexually active, everybody you are sexually, everybody you have ever been sexually active with, and everybody they've ever been sexually active with is a potential stream of risk for you to get the deadly virus and die, right? So that would, if you, yeah, it was virtually all of us. And I was terrified, and I only got one HIV test ever in my life, and, you know, shaking from head to toe, crying, the whole nine yards. I had the whole programming running. So I think I did it to work through that fear. And very early on, I came across an interview with Peter Duisberg on the cover of a weekly gay periodical called The New York Native. And it contrasted Bob Gallo and Peter Duisberg. Bob Gallo on the cover quoted saying, HIV kills like a truck. It would kill Clark Kent. And Duisberg saying, that virus is harmless. I wouldn't mind being injected with it. And again, I was like, wow, you know, youthful excitement. And so I ran back to the magazine and to my editor, Bob Keating, look what we have. We got to do the story. And I was utterly kiboshed by him initially. We're not talking about this. We're not doing this. But I had already put a call out to Peter Duisberg. Perhaps I should slow down a bit. I had put a call into his office, and I was commanded by my editor, who I reported to, not to drop the story, hot potato story. We weren't even going to talk about it. But as fate would have it, Duisberg had gotten my message, and early the next morning, my phone rang, and I answered it from a dead sleep, and it was Peter Duisberg calling from Berkeley, ready to do an interview. So I jumped out of bed. I turned on my tape recorder. We did the interview there and then. Fascinating. And I transcribed it there and then, still in my pajamas. I transcribed the whole thing. And then I took it to the editor-in-chief. I just put it under his office door. And I said, that's all I can do. And he called me that night and he said, I read it. And this is the most important interview I will ever publish in my life.
Amazing. So tell people what Duesberg's thoughts were. Like, what was that interview? What did you guys say and what published?
Peter Duesberg said, okay, I'm going to try to keep this very short and very simple. I will really try. Because you can, okay, the early cartoon, let's say cartoon version, which was also psychological terror for real of HIV, was that it came from Africa via a Canadian flight attendant who it turns out did not exist, called Patient Zero. And he brought it into the gay community first, and it was spreading there and it was killing there. And it was had also gone into the general bloodstream and could spread via blood contact of factor VIII for hemophiliacs. But also, let's remember, Fauci was saying toilet seats and salad leaves and all these ways you could children could catch it in a household. It was just, you know, dreadful, very familiar to what we've been going through these last 2 years, where there's no epidemiological base for what they're saying. Something that ever transmitted like this, some disease that ever functioned like this. But B, you're never allowed to object to that. Well, I'm not really worried. I think, you know, so we're all in this scare cloud. And Duesberg said, coming at it as a retrovirologist, which was a new breed of virologist. Today, all of it is coming into question, and I want to acknowledge that. We're rethinking a lot of things. What's a virus? So retrovirology was a burgeoning field, and he had been brought over from Germany, from the Max Planck Institute, as an elite premier cancer virologist, essentially, which kind of merged with retrovirologists. So he was, at the time, one of the things that was often repeated about Peter was that Bob Gallo himself had said in an introduction, when they were friends, and he had introduced Peter at a talk and said, this man knows more about retroviruses than any man alive. And he had, quote, mapped the genetic structure of retroviruses and was one of the youngest members ever inducted into the National Academy of Sciences and was one of a handful of top-funded American scientists, again, imported from Germany. Max Planck Institute had the kind of funding where he didn't even have to do grant. He didn't even have to put in for grants. He had something called an outstanding investigator grant that lasted for 7 years of funding, which is unheard of. So his troubles began at the beginning of that. So that was one thing that was a little bit lucky. Fauci cut him off as soon as he dissented from dogma, but he still had a few years to live on that grant, you know, I mean, to keep getting funding for his work. So what happened was he wrote a paper in a journal called Cancer Research, and it was mostly about retroviruses and cancers, saying, I don't see the connection. I don't see that cancer. I don't see any cancer caused by viruses or retroviruses, because that was also kind of the burgeoning, a lot of BS in that and a lot of money and BS in that. And he was, before HIV, he had shot down many lucrative fake virus cancer theories before he even got to HIV. And in that paper, he said, kind of as an afterthought, there's no retroviral cause for this syndrome called AIDS. It's not possible. Retroviruses, he said, I'm quoting Duesberg here, so nobody who hears this says there's no such thing. I'm just quoting Duesberg here. So at the time, he said retroviruses are known to be pussycat viruses. They don't infect or kill or terminate cells en masse. They don't do that. They don't do anything. They don't really move. They don't kill cells. They're not a problem. We've always known they're not a problem. We've wished there would be a terrible retrovirus so we would have, you know, raison d'etre, but we don't have one. So this one is no different from any other. Why is everybody getting excited and calling this the cause of AIDS? It was, if memory serves, just a few paragraphs in this paper in a very esteemed journal. Well, it was flagged at the White House. It was flagged. I mean, it was flagged at the
NIH.
NIH, yeah, communications department. But, you know, this, we've gotten some calls from, probably they got a call from the New York Native, I'm guessing. I can't imagine who else it was. Why wasn't this flagged? In other words, why was this allowed to go out? And why don't we already have crushing counter narrative out there about this? So Duisberg wasn't just saying, I don't think HIV causes AIDS. He was saying, no, we all know. We all knew the week before this press conference of Bob Gallo saying we have found the cause of AIDS. We all knew that retroviruses were not causes of anything. In fact, we used them as vectors for gene therapy.
So he's basically saying there's no way that this retrovirus could cause anything. And he was the Malone McCullough Corey of his day, right?
Totally. Yes. And what was fascinating about it to me as a rookie journalist was that he came from the top. In other words, they had already minted him as such in all the ways that they do that, that they did that then in American Science, like kind of before Fauci has completed his terror reign. He was acknowledged and funded and awarded and decorated and so on and so on. And so they couldn't call him crazy rubbish, right? And yet they did. And I saw that play out blow by blow, and all of us did. We could not believe it. So I got to really witness firsthand the reputation demolition machine, the degradation machine. And we've all been living through that. You guys have, all of us have. We all see it now. It's what they do. It's what they do at their factory. They take a stellar reputation and they return it in pieces, in degradation. That's what they try to do.
So it's especially not now. And you had this whole interview with him. You transcribe it, you give it, and Spin publishes the interview where Duisberg basically says, you know, this virus is not causing AIDS. Is that the crux of what the interview was?
Yeah. It's harmless.
And
it's
then
not
what
doing
happened?
Anything. So what happened next was I can't remember that much of like the days after it got published, but I know there began to be a feeling of storm, trouble, people at the magazine getting upset, people bursting into tears, this kind of thing, getting phone calls. I got a phone call from the National Cancer Institute press office informing me that because of what I had done, I would never be allowed access to any NCI scientist ever. That's National Cancer Institute, where all this was playing out at the time, because of what I had done to Dr. Gallo by interviewing Duisberg. The next column, we got a phone call from an outstanding British reporter who was living in New York named Anthony Liversidge. And he said, I called Gallo up after your interview was published and I recorded his response. And it was and he said, it's an amazing transcript. I want to submit it as a column. So my editor and I, who had since been kind of brought around to understanding, okay, we're doing this, we actually walked over to his apartment. We got this transcript, and that was column number two, Gallo answering Duisberg in the most profanity-laced rants. Really, really funny. That is a piece of just golden comedy, that one. So that was column number two. And with that, we were off to the races, right? We were in it. We had staked out our, like, okay, this is a war. We have our two, you know, kind of boxers in their corners here. We have Duisberg, we have Gallo. And then we just kept going from there. Different people coming in from different sides of this thing. And the AIDS column, it was called Words from the Front, was the place where this secret war that was never in any of the mainstream press, you know, where people could read about it. So it was both loved and hated, as you can imagine. The staff mostly hated it and wanted it gone and worked very hard to get rid of it. But the readers loved it. And our next battle was the AZT battle. AZT was a major battle. And I don't want to go off in a whole thing about AZT, but you see it in the Remdesivir story. It's the same playbook, but it was much more dramatic then because AZT was literally causing people to, it's like Hiroshima, you know, to the cells.
Wasn't this the medicine that pregnant woman you wrote of took?
The pregnant woman I wrote of took actually an even worse drug. She was indeed in a trial where she could have been given AZT, and it's possible that she had some combination that AZT was involved, but primarily she was killed by an HIV drug called nevirapine, which is so toxic.
Let's talk about her, because that was a story you told me that I then later read when you sent it to me in print, you know, basically scanned column form. So I don't want to skip too far ahead in the story, but this is something that everybody really needs to hear. So I want to talk about it real quick and we can go backwards. It was when you had written for Harper's, you wrote a story about a pregnant woman, and I'll let you tell the story because it is mind blowing. And then tell us what happened at Harper's after this was published.
Yeah, the woman's name was Joyce Ann Hafford. She was a Black woman living in Memphis, Tennessee. She was a single mom to a 12-year-old boy at the time. And she got pregnant and she went in for prenatal care. And she was approached by her OBGYN. And then I want you to imagine behind the scenes here, the funding for, in other words, they'll set up an HIV drug trial and the funding comes in based on basically on a bounty system. You get it, right? Like how many people they can get roped into this trial. So when they start testing women who are healthy and pregnant, they're going to turn up some positives. And this gets really shocking and bizarre, and we can't go into it too much, but I'll just tell you. Being pregnant can cause a cross reaction on an HIV test very easily, very often, very common thing.
What kind of a test were they using, Celia?
There were Western blot tests was the common test at the time. So Western blot, if you were to like unfold the test insert and read the whole thing, you would faint. You wouldn't believe it because A, it says these are all the things this test can cross react with that are not HIV, but nobody knows that and nobody's told that. And it also says this test cannot test for the presence or absence of HIV. Kid you not. Okay, so this is where the test manufacturers protected themselves from liability. And this is the holy SHIT vortex that takes years and years to get into and even longer to get out of, how they do it with the biotech, how they get us into these, how they can sink an entire society with a wrongly cast diagnostic test that terrorizes perfectly healthy people. Let's just keep it simple.
Yeah.
Tells them they're going to get something in the future. It's like sorcery, right? I mean, to me, that's my word now, sorcery.
Yeah. So, I'm making the parallel because the test is at the root of everything as we've lived through again now. So continue the story. I'm so sorry.
No, please. Okay, so let's see. So Joyce Ann Hafford is a few months pregnant. She's healthy. She's asked, "Do you want to get an HIV test?" Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm fine. Well, you know, don't you want to? If you have it, you'd want to protect your baby, wouldn't you? Well, of course. So you see how they do it. So she's tested. She comes up positive. Now she's told, well, as luck would have it, we have a clinical trial right now here at this hospital testing this drug and that drug and the other drug for that can prevent HIV transmission for a pregnant woman, such as yourself, who's HIV positive. So she has absolutely no idea there's any problem with any of this. Her only instinct is to protect her baby. And her, I interviewed her sister for the Harper story. She said she just kept saying, I got to save my baby. I got to save my baby. So she enters the trial, and it was actually comparing, here was their phrase, treatment limiting toxicities of different combinations of very toxic HIV drugs, treatment limiting toxicity. So,
they're basically using a pregnant woman to test how toxic drugs are and which ones they can combine without hurting them.
Yeah. Yeah. You just cannot believe it. You know, so when I heard Laura Logan say that she didn't say Fauci is like Mengele. She said, if you listen carefully, she said, I'm hearing people say that that's how they feel about him. But that's what was coming back, you know, from the street of people she was listening to, like, wow, this guy is like, and if you read this, okay, so let me slow down and go back to the story. So Joyce gets enrolled in this hideous, hideous trial that is incomprehensibly putting pregnant women who are healthy, who are not diagnostically AIDS. They don't have anything wrong with their CD4 cells. They've had no symptoms. They're just HIV positive on a test that admits it can't tell whether a person has ever been exposed to HIV or not. The whole thing is, okay. So she starts taking a drug. She doesn't know which one it is. Now within, obviously because it's, you know, blinded, immediately she becomes violently ill. And we're talking nausea, inability to keep food down, jaundice, more vomiting, like really extreme jaundice, real signs of, pretty quickly after she went on it. So now she's just in a life and death battle there's no part of even of her that's saying, take me off this, I'm dying, right? And her sister said, she just kept saying, her sister was saying, you're really sick, Joyce. And Joyce said, I know, but I have to save my baby. So it's so evil that they tap into the strongest, most primordial good instinct in a person, in a woman, a mother like that. And they know exactly how that works, you know. So she gets sicker and sicker and is finally brought into ICU. They watch her liver crashing and failing. I don't know how to explain this, but they do not take her off the drug. And finally, they did take her off it. Finally, she was coming in and out of consciousness. She was in ICU, full hepatic failure, full jaundice. And they took her off it, and she died maybe 2 days later. They saved the baby. He was born by C-section. She was actually able to hold him just before she died. She knew she had a boy. And she died. And what happens next is exactly what you used the phrase mind-blowing. Yeah, it's mind-blowing and it's soul-crushing. What happens next is, so her son is woken up, you know, early in the morning and told that his mother has died, and he just collapses.
The other sobbing. Son? What, did she have another son?
She was a single mom. She had a 12-year-old son at home, and she was his whole life. Jamal was his name. And he and the sister and Joyce's mom all went to the hospital, and there was Joyce deceased in the hospital bed. And they were told, they're sitting around and they're weeping. And they were told, the head doctor or whoever comes down and says, well, this can happen, you know, it's rapidly progressed AIDS. And
just like rapidly progressed COVID in remdesivir patients. I'm just making the parallels.
Yep. And somebody there at the hospital said, whispered, you have a lawsuit. They did file a lawsuit. Honestly, it went on back and forth for years. I don't really know what the upshot of it was. I know because I thought the little baby at the time, Sterling, he's doing well. I actually found him and his aunt who raised him on Facebook, and he's graduated college and he's doing great. So thank God for that. Anyway, so back to, so they, the lying and the sorcery, the deception, the cruelty is all there. And frankly, I have to say the racism in all of this is very pronounced. It feels like they knew this family would not be able to, you know, really fight them. And in a sense that there would be that, I think they just, well, leave that aside. We don't need speculation. We have a lot of facts still to deal with. So let me get back to the fact that, okay, so there they are at the hospital bed and they're told that Joyce had died of rapidly progressed AIDS, and Ruby is the name of Joyce's sister. She was saying, something's not right here, something's not right. And it wasn't until John Solomon picked up on the lawsuit that was going on with Jonathan Fishbein, who later became a NIAID whistleblower because Fauci had pushed him out of a job, partly because he had raised red flags about this situation. What they did was they sent each other emails while they were telling the family that Joyce had died of rapidly progressed AIDS, they being the Division of AIDS, Fauci's officers had emailed each other saying, and this is a direct quote, oops, looks like we had a nevirapine. No, I'm sorry. First quote was, looks like we've had a nevirapine death in Memphis. And I believe that was from Fishbein. And then this doctor named Ed Tremont comes back and says, oops, not much we can do about dumb docs. And he had even misspelled the word dumb. So, so the cavalier, this is why I say racism, you know, like this absolutely detached, disassociated, sociopathic, cavalier attitude, playing with lives, playing with, you know, tinker toys, drugs, entire families. And the thing that makes all of it makes my blood boil, but that lie at her deathbed just strikes me as so completely sinister and evil. And that's how they created the AIDS PSYOP, as they created the COVID PSYOP, so that it always stretches it's always the perfect cover for all their crimes, always. Virus.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so this was happening all over the country to so many people. You published the story, Harper's published the story, and there was basically a firestorm afterwards. And the thing that struck me the most about this, given, you know, the situation we're in, They wouldn't take the story down no matter the pressure. And you'll tell this in a second. But they did decide that you were expendable to some degree. So tell that part of this horrible story.
Yeah, well, so we built it for 2 years. The story, it was Lewis Lapham, who was then the editor of Harper's. I was at a function event with him, and he said, can you write about science for me? I don't like the way anybody writes about science for me. And I said, I think I can. And about a year later, I pitched a story that was what Fauci had done to Peter Duisberg, who had by then formulated the new theory of cancer. So it was going to be a piece all about the rise and fall of Peter Duisberg in this kind of Fauci Reich. Rise and fall and rise, that was the story. And he accepted the pitch. He said, it sounds very interesting. I got busy writing that. And then when we learned through John Solomon about Fishbein, the story grew and darkened and expanded, and it became a 2-year process. We worked on it for 2 years. We fact checked it for 4 solid months. And when it was coming out, I felt as much as I know, I thought I knew the enemy, I didn't really, because what they're best at is turning like you throw a flaming javelin at them and it's solid and it's fact checks and full of facts and it's kaboom, right? And they take it midair, they can turn around and send it right back on you. Tracy, you know what I'm talking mm-hmm, about, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That's what I hadn't anticipated, and that's what they did. So what they did was they concocted this, and it was a group of pharmaceutical-funded activists in South Africa, and they conceived of a new PSYOP and launched it. And the new PSYOP was, they titled it 56 Errors in Farber Harper's article, and they made this graph, this chart, and they got all the big, scary, angry AIDS researchers to sign on to it. And they had like degrees of error, you know, and I looked at it and I would say that it was over 90% thought crimes. So of course I was committing thought crimes in every sentence against the way you're supposed to think about AIDS. Let me give you an example. An African-American woman in Memphis, Tennessee, who's pregnant and gets into an AIDS drug trial, that's supposed to be great. That's progress. That's good. That's called access. And if she dies, well, that's called probably, you know, usually they actually would call that adherence failure, that somebody didn't adhere to their regimen. You wouldn't believe the language they've concocted to explain every form of destruction and murder. Well, you probably would. Okay, so the piece comes out and there's like a silence for a few days. And then I remember sensing it like a rumbling coming, like a rumbling ball of fire coming down the hill with my name on it. And that's when I saw, my editor called me and said, we've gotten this kind of manifesto. And the manifesto was from an international phalanx of AIDS researchers and activists, and Gallo was on it, and Treatment Action Group people, and Greg Gonzalez, and I don't know if you know who these people are. And they were first saying that I had made 56 errors in the article, and that this article was so riddled with errors that it was constituted, of course, a danger to public health and to the reputation of Harper's, and unhealable wound to the AIDS activist community, which had faith in Harper's prior to this, et cetera, et cetera. So they made a bunch of terroristic demands, including that the article be retracted, apologized and atoned for, that they come in and do another article of the same length in the next issue, where they would bring their own fact checkers and it would be all about how AIDS drugs have saved people around the world. They were going to bring their own fact checkers, as Farber apparently did. They believed I brought my own, you know, fact checker monkeys, and just kind of let them loose there at Harper's to fact check this piece.
The same way PolitiFact does today, you know?
Yeah, right. Right. All the stuff about fact checkers was just, you know, kicking in around this time. So this is 2006. They demanded that the editors, several of the top editors, resign, that they do so on it was supposed to be on a Monday outside the building of Harper's. They were doxing several of the editors who were editors and fact checkers and copy editors who worked on it. So there was a wild wave of, you know, fear and anxiety inside the magazine. They weren't used to this kind of thing. And my editor, who was quite excellent, Roger Hodge, he's now at The Intercept, he had to prioritize, I would say, protecting the magazine, the staff. Louis Lapham was, that was his last issue. So he was on his way out to go do something else anyway, Lapham's Quarterly. I've spoken to him, met with him several times since, and he was not aware of any profound trauma at the time, and nor was Rick MacArthur, the owner of Harper's. It happened more at the lower levels. And I was, I tread gently here because I'm not sure. I don't want to really point fingers, but it's just kind of the way the cookie crumbles is that somebody's got to be sacrificed. And so naturally it had to be me. Now, Harper's never turned against a single word of that piece or me at all. They defended their piece. It was a Harper's piece, let's remember. And Roger was raked over the coals and they didn't want to talk to me at all because I was completely, pariah, anathema. Yeah. But they got him on some of their shows and tried to beat him up and box him around. Roger's a tough guy. And he just, we stand by our story and this is what the story speaks to and is about. And she's a brave journalist. She's been covering this for many years. So I really was a reasonable person to put on a story like that. I've been covering AIDS for 25 years. But they said, you, Harper's, actually the Columbia Journalism Review wrote a piece saying that Harper's had, quote, committed suicide. Harper's had committed, this is the oldest magazine in America, older than the New York Times. And Harper's had committed suicide, and it was a huge crisis in journalism and science journalism, so much so that they had a panel discussion, which is still available online, and a transcript, a panel discussion at the Toronto International AIDS Conference in 2006 with Richard Horton of The Lancet and Marilyn Chase of Wall Street Journal and Lori Garrett and John Moore from Weill Cornell and all of them. And it was about how do we make sure nothing like this ever happens again? Mm. It was a crisis conference about that article. And their answer was essentially, we got to seal up the whole system so that we build and are and fund the so-called journalism schools, and people have to have degrees in public health and masters in public, all these things before we, the public health journalism Kremlin, agree to let them publish anything on anything. So this kind of thing doesn't happen again. See? So what happened to me was I entered into what turned out to be the, frankly, a decade of almost indescribable turmoil and downfall. And because I didn't know then what I know now. I didn't know how to, for example, not take it personally. So all the things that happened to targeted individuals happened to me. Loss of reputation, loss of income, loss of career, loss of drive, will, loss of health, loss of, the marriage takes hits, everything falls apart, and it's designed that way. So that was, frankly, it was very rough, and I remember being absolutely petrified in my bones because of the way they bully is not like, we hated that article, here's our letter to the editor. It's more like, you are going to get it and you're never going to walk free again. And they make sure you know that and you feel that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's
so I do this to bring us, and I'm not trying to cut it short because I could sit and talk to you about this for hours, but I do this to bring us to our conversation we had, because you said you were almost, reticent to get in, to talk about this stuff again, because you could see that it was the same thing happening over again. And you said to me, Tracy, Carrie Mullis, you can't use the PCR test. You can't. And I said, okay, explain this to me. So I know we're kind of jumping, but I wanted to give the background of kind of how, a brief background of where you came from. And I would really, before we end, and I don't know if we'll have time, get your brief opinion on HIV, being that it's jumping back into the news cycle so much lately. Tell me about how you met Carrie Mullis and wrote that article in April of 2020, probably an article that has, Celia, been published in print all over the world, translated into 11 different languages, and been used in court hearings overseas about the PCR test.
Yes, and I just want to take a brief moment to thank you, and hats off to you, Tracy, because you nothing like that happens without the editor. You acted like the, it's like you were like the perfect God-given editor at the right time that you dared to do that. Very few people would have dared publish that piece. And I don't think either of us realized how that would hit the culture at that time. I'm very proud of it. And I'm really proud that we did it together.
I'm proud of it too. For those of you who may not know, the title of the piece is, was the COVID-19 test, what is it, meant to detect a virus?
Meant to detect a virus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you knew Carrie Mullis. You somehow broke through to this man who was not a very, open man. It was a very interesting personality. And because of that, you knew what happened with the PCR test that they were now using to test for COVID-19. And I believe they used to test for HIV too, did they not?
Yeah, so it was perfect merging of, so Carrie Mullis invented PCR sometime in the, I think it was in the late 80s. I was the first journalist in the early 90s to interview him on the record. I caught up with him during a snowstorm in a hotel lobby in New Jersey, where he had given a talk. Somehow I knew he was, somebody told me he was giving this talk. I somehow got through to him and he said, if you can get here in this snowstorm, I'll talk to you. So I got there and I interviewed him, and it was the first interview about how he felt about how they, AIDS Inc., were trying to use PCR then to crush Peter Duesberg, who he, Carrie, believed was correct that HIV was not the cause of AIDS. And he said, do not use my technology to try to crush that outstanding scientist who absolutely makes sense and is absolutely correct that HIV cannot cause AIDS, because all PCR will do is take the same nothing, little speck of nothing, maybe one molecule, and blow it up to make it look like it's, so that's exactly what they were doing. They were saying, well, Duesberg may have had a point in 1987 that HIV, it can't be seen in that many cells, but with PCR, we can find it everywhere. And Carrie was like, no, you can't. It's the same nothing. You're just doing wizardry. You know, you're just, it's just a deceptive presentation where it looks, So this is the way science was really going and is continuing to go, that instead of staying in the real, in the corporeal, right? Like with as you also published bravely, the fact that SARS-CoV-2 doesn't have a corpus at all, as far as I know, it's just algorithms being sent around. So they're playing all these tricks. Now, Carrie was adamant and staunch, and that was the way he was his whole life. So he was what we called an AIDS dissident and what they called an AIDS denier. And he got the Nobel Prize for PCR after he became an out of the closet. He was never in the closet, but he went on record with me, with Neville Hodgkinson in London, and with others defending Peter Duesberg. And he nevertheless got the Nobel Prize, which shocked me at the time. If Carrie were alive to see this, I fear it would kill him. He passed in 2019, as we all know. I do not have any details about anything surrounding his death, but it is absolutely a replay, a deja vu, where PCR. Now, Carrie Mullis did not invent any PCR test. He invented the PCR technology. So what's going on today? The world has been terrorized and sunk into tyranny by way of demonic misuse of PCR. That's mostly how they've done it. As Raina Fulmick always says, this is just a pandemic of PCR tests. And Dr. Dave Raznick, who you also know of, Tracy, he has always said, if you were abolish the HIV test and you'll get rid of AIDS. It's always the test is how they do it.
Which is what they're doing now by abolishing testing, basically, for COVID to get rid of the virus, in quotes. I mean, you know, the parallels to all of this are just absolutely stunning. And again, like when you came to me, you were like, I have to say something about this. Oh, my gosh, it's happening all over again. Like very, very early, Celia. We were on the phone in February.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
I was on the phone with you when we both saw on our screen. You saw it first and you said the first U.S. case. And I said, you're kidding.
Yep.
What they called the first U.S. And that was when I think we both got this really sinking feeling, right? Do you remember that?
I do. I do. I remember I was sitting outside on my porch and we were having this conversation. I'll never forget it because you took the time to go through a lot more than we got to talk about today about HIV and AIDS. And I said, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. I said, you know what? And you were like, we have to talk about this. And I'm like, not yet, because I really didn't think that the public was ready to understand and hear all of that yet. And there's so much more than even what we've even dabbled in today. But I think they are now, especially, and let's just, you know, we don't have to get into technical detail here because it's still all pitter pattering out. And what's basically happening right now is an uptick in HIV discussion across the world with what looks like the same way they're doing with the clots and the heart attacks and the cold and every other side effect of this, quote, vaccine that's going on right now. They're starting to talk about HIV making a comeback and this virulent strain that has been around for a very long time, but is now all of a sudden exploding in the Netherlands. You know, Prince Harry talking about making sure you get tested for HIV and all of this stuff. What in a sentence or two, if you can, I don't even know. What is HIV? Is HIV a thing? Or is it not?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Okay. There is no proof that I know of the existence of a coherent virus called HIV. Did I just disconnect myself or am I still here? Can you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. That, I'll just say quickly, that was advanced by a group of brilliant scientists in Perth, Australia. They're called the Perth Group, and you can go to theperthgroup.com and read their whole argument. They were at odds with Duisberg, who said, I think they did sequence something, but it's harmless and it doesn't cause AIDS. That was a bigger fight than you can imagine, and is again a huge fight. Does SARS-CoV-2 exist at all? Was it isolated? Was it purified? No. You know, all of those standards are long gone. So we're not doing classical virology at all anymore. So we're really in this wild terra incognita, each man fending for himself with this stuff. But I will say this, that when you see a Prince Harry coming out, all these things you mentioned, holy globalist psyop, they're bringing back the most important thing to understand. And I said this in Mr. Kennedy's book and in a long quote that's about woke coming in to the gates of to American science, to the NIH, the division of AIDS. And AIDS is how it comes in. And Fauci is who raises it to a new kind of dark economic global art form that you take. So when Prince Harry is saying you better get tested for HIV, he's not saying you might get symptoms or see if you have Kaposi's sarcoma. See, he's tapping into that thing. Like, we're not like them, so it's hard for us to get our minds around it. But it's like a globalist psyop-y guilt trip about how everyone was supposed to get AIDS, you know, 30 years ago, and you're still not off the hook. You still are going to get it, or you should have it, or all it means is that they've done something with their biotech sorcery where there's HIV proteins that used to be only associated with the HIV tests that are somehow now mixed up with something to do with COVID tests.
I think it's,
does that make sense?
Yes, but I think it's a cover for what the vaccine is doing to the immune system. That's what I think.
Oh, yeah. Right. And we should hold them to this. You guys, your theory was this: sex causes transmission of HIV. So how did all these people, and now if that's the case, surely Bill Clinton has AIDS. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm being really simplistic, but they have to be the best way for people to understand why is Fauci a fraud and a liar and a catastrophe for the United States and for the world is go back and look at what he said was going to happen, and none of it came true. First of all, it was supposed to be an HIV vaccine after 2 years. There was supposed to be a heterosexual sexual explosion, 90 million heterosexual Americans dead from AIDS by 1990, Africa wiped off the map. You guys may be a little too young to remember some of this, like the really early gory propaganda. I feel like that's where everybody needs to go to be completely immune to PSYOPs as they continue to be pelted with them, which is what's happening now. But I agree with you, Tracy. They're up to something that has to do with the cover story from vaccine damage and death, which is at catastrophic levels, as we know.
I'm going to let Frank see if he's got a question before we let you go. But I do want to ask you if you could just give our listeners a couple of things that they should go and read in your opinion to get caught up on this. Before you do that, Frank, any questions for this crazy interview?
Celia, did you know Liam Sheff?
I did. I knew him well.
He was a good friend of mine too. That's how I learned about all this.
Journalist. Outstanding.
Yeah, that's how I learned about the tests, the dilution of the tests and everything else you're talking about here. So I was wondering how personal you might have, how close you might have been with him.
Yeah, when he really came wonderful to New York to break the legendary ICC story, which keeps trying to come back and they keep pushing it down, about the torture and death of Black and Hispanic orphans at an orphanage in Harlem. When he came to New York to do that story, he stayed with me, actually. So that's how I got to know him. That was like 2003, 2004. And he was a blazing comet, and he was so outstanding. And he I try to just kind of send messages to him. He's gone now, for the listeners who don't know.
Yeah.
He passed away. What was it, 4 years ago?
Yeah. Just about that.
He was public about it, that he ended his life. I don't know if he would have said he was a targeted individual, but he suffered from extreme tinnitus.
Yeah, it was after some invasive dental surgery. It got worse and worse. But that's I just bring this up because everything you're talking about here today is part of the reason why I believe that his work has been cited many times over the last few years by growing media outlets with growing popularity. But they never go deeper into, and they always disclaim that that he has controversial views of HIV and all that. So that's why they don't go even deeper into his work and everything that you're talking about right now. It's still a very sacred cow they don't want to touch at all. And I think that it needs to be touched.
Have you read Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book? It's a lot to read, I know, but
I own it. It came in finally.
That's a good start. Okay. So Liam is all over that, you know, and you'll see when you read it, you'll see. But yes, a lot of people picking up the story, they try to de-Liam the story. They take the story and run with it. And I want to say there's an outlet that we all read that did that, but I'm terrified I'll get it wrong, but I want to say Gateway Pundit, and I wrote them a letter about it.
They did that to him twice.
So I'm right. It was Gateway Pundit.
Oh, yeah. Because I brought some attention to that, too. I said it was, ridiculous. It's easy. If you're going to cite him.
That was terrible. Yeah, I agree. I wrote to them, and so did the president of our group called Rethinking AIDS. Yeah. So let's see. What was your question? Oh, so you asked, did I know Liam? Yes. And Liam was absolutely. Really, Frank, what we should do is see what's still left of. There's an interview Liam did. When you say they're going to take this down, and then when you go look for it again, it's down, right? But there's an interview that Liam did that was so stunning. That laid out everything about the. Or I think the orphanage, the story of what happened there is I think even the AIDS orthodoxy knows that if people knew about that, they would turn against them. So I'm going to try to find this interview. I'm going to try to send it to you.
I could link it to you because I just reshared it again over the weekend. And I've done this interview with him a couple of times on my own show years ago. And not only that, but I would also say that he did a fantastic, very long, detailed chapter in his book, Official Stories. And the chapter was called The Scarlet Letter. If you haven't read that in a while, Celia, I think you should.
I'll go back to Official Stories. Yeah. Yeah. And we should also try to make sure that his videos that he put up online don't disappear into the Bermuda Triangle.
Right.
Yeah. Liam Sheff, amazing journalist.
Amazing. So if some folks out in the audience wanted to, well, first of all, you've obviously got a Substack, which I absolutely adore and I'm subscribed to, which I'll put in the show notes. What other materials do you think you could recommend to folks to read that would catch them up on this? Or can you quickly, you know, send me some stuff to link in show notes today for folks so that they can catch up with what you've done over your career, which has been amazing?
Yeah, I can do both. What's a really good hub and starting place and very easy to remember is Duesberg.com, where he's got a lot of the, not just the papers he wrote, but all of us AIDS dissidents, as we were called. You know, we were publishing and doing this for years and years and years. And so the most pinnacle ones, like John Lauritsen's writings on AZT, my writings on all of this, Liam's stuff is up there. So Duesberg.com is a really good starting point for both scientific papers and journalistic articles. There's also RethinkingAIDS.com. I'll send you links, Tracy.
Yeah, no worries.
I'll do it right after we sign off. And as for my stuff, there's a piece that I wrote about what they did to Peter Duesberg called The Passion of Peter Duesberg, which is chapter one in my book. I'm going to reissue soon. And I republished it at my Substack recently, about a month ago. And I feel like that's a really good place to start also, because what I really want people to understand, and they can see it, and I want people, everybody does understand it now. What's going on, it's happened to you, Tracy. It's happening to Joe Rogan right now. It happens. That thing is really the story. Do you see what I mean? The degradation apparatus.
Yep.
And the tarnishing, that is to say, we have one problem, and our one problem is that we didn't snuff out woke and its killing powers.
We also didn't have the internet the way we do now. And I think that that's been really a huge thing. We're right at an hour. Celia, I love you. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us today. Frank had to jump because we're a little late on our side. So this is gonna be great for folks to listen to. I'm gonna put everything that you mentioned in the show notes along with your Substack so they can follow along with your great work. And I hope to publish something from you at Uncover DC again really soon.
I would love that. Yes. lost in the storm, but I'd love to come back, and I love you too. And thank you for having me on the show. I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, you're great. Celia Farmer, everybody.
This is an Ian Beckles Flava in Your Ear quick fix on Radio Influence.
This whole Joe Rogan thing, and Joe Rogan has his own podcast, and it so happens to be the most popular podcast in the world, and he's doing very, very well. And as someone who's been doing podcasts for a while, you have to look up to a Joe Rogan and what he's accomplished in a very short amount of time, and he's a don, you know? So he definitely deserves his respect. When all this stuff came out, and it came out, there's going to be one side that says, you know, somebody's whistleblowing and they're just putting this together and it's a smear job. I'm not that person. I don't care. Okay, listen, you said it, okay? Joe Rogan, you said it. That's it. It will look and sound a lot different when you splice it together, okay? So I'm going to start by saying this, people. And I said this before on this show many times before. It's just a word. Racism is not a word. Racism is in your heart because you guys know it. And the people who bicker about, well, you're saying it, you're the racists, all right? Because I have Caucasian friends who I've heard use the N-word and it didn't faze me. It don't faze me. You know why? Because they're not racist. And this is the unfortunate part. If you're Caucasian, it's up to us whether it's okay or not. You really don't have any say in it. Does that sound un-American? Well, if it's to you, it's un-American, but we didn't make the damn word up. And I'm going to say this about Joe Rogan. I didn't have a problem with Joe Rogan before I heard the allegations. And I still don't have a problem with Joe Rogan. You know why? Listen to this part of it. I don't know Joe Rogan. If I knew Joe Rogan, I'd be able to speak on behalf of Joe Rogan, okay? I don't know him. So for somebody who doesn't know somebody, for me to hear something or a word he said, not even getting the context of it, for me to dislike him is ignorant and childish for me.
You can find Ian Beckles' Flavor in Your Ear on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.